Following World War II, there were 200 French soldiers returned to France, and because of their prison camp experiences, had completely forgotten who they were. Upon arriving, some of them were, of course, recognized by other soldiers, and records were found that matched military personnel. Yet there were still 32 who no one knew who they were. So they needed somebody to tell them their stories. They put pictures in national magazines saying that on a certain day at the Opera House, these men will be up front if anybody could recognize them. Well, the day finally arrived, and Pierre was the first to walk out on stage and under a lone spotlight, speaking gently into the darkness, he said, "Does anybody out there know who I am?" He had completely lost his identity. We are our stories. His stories had been erased, and it left him without an identification. We all need stories far more than we need our facts. Pierre already knew some of his facts. He knew his profession. He knew his height and weight. He knew his rough age. But he didn't know his stories. What he was hoping for that day is that somebody would cry out from the audience, "Son, sweetheart, don't you remember? You romanced me in our 20s with all the picnics by the Eiffel Tower." He needed somebody to fill in the stories. We are our stories. They tell us who we are, why we're here, what we're here to do. Same was true of Israel. Some 3,500 years ago, an entire people group had just been released from slavery, and they were wandering through the wilderness together and spoke softly into the night sky. "Does anybody up there know who we are?" And God in his grace responded by giving them their story. In the beginning, I created everything. And a story that came to them in a way that they would understand it. You know, as many of you know, those first five books of the Bible are called the Torah. They were originally given and meant to be understood all together. Torah meaning law. And they follow the exact pattern of treaties that accompany that time period in the ancient Near East. Treaties at that time don't start with the stipulations like between countries. They start with a prelude that reviews the two countries' history. It tells where they came from. Then it gives the stipulations, which is the law. And then it talks about the aftermath of the treaty. The purpose of reviewing the history of the two parties is to engender gratitude. I'm getting a good deal here. It's to engender respect. Ooh, if I don't abide by this treaty, it doesn't go well for me. And mostly it's to engender trust. These people can be counted on, that it's been this way before. And that's what this portions of the stories up to the giving of the law in Exodus are doing here in a way that these people could understand it. The totality of the 66 books that we call the Bible, of course, is a story. Even the other forms of the literature within it, like, for example, law or prophecy or apocalyptic literature, it all exists as part of the story. It was given to us as a story quite on purpose. It's the main tool, of course, that Jesus used to communicate his parables, in part because the stories invite you to engage. They invite you to search, to chew, or to rummage. Seems like about every household has one of these. The junk drawer. We know what we're looking for is in the drawer. But we've all probably spent so much time standing over one of these drawers, right? Rummaging through. Looking at it from a different angle, thinking you've got it, but then it's not there and you have to move some more things. We know what we're looking for is in that drawer. But it's not immediately available to us, and so we have to rummage. We have to rummage through the drawer to find what it is that we are looking for. Israel in the wilderness needed to rummage. Who are we? We today need to rummage. Who is it that God is really? What are people here for? You know, the scripture is given in story form because the best learning takes place when we engage and we rummage the story. We look back at this epic that is given to us in the book of Genesis here in this new year. We look back and allow it to tell us what is important in life, to allow the story to make sense of our lives and give meaning to them. We need to rummage together. In this new year, we're encouraging everybody to read that story once again, the book of Genesis, and simply talk about it. You know, some groups that meet Sunday morning or whatever groups you're normally participating in or in a one-on-one, simply engage that story. What are you seeing? What's disturbing you? What's moving you forward? And uniquely this year, I'm asking if everyone would consider rummaging their own lives in a daily way. It's called the prayer of examine. It's where we simply finish a day by inviting the Lord's gaze. And we walk through the moments of the day conscious of what was going on. And we ask God, where was I close to you? Where did I drift? And far most importantly in that, why? What motivated the movements of the day? As we get into that practice, we're able to better critique our own stories so that we can have a better one tomorrow. The whole point of rummaging and looking back is that we would have then a better tomorrow. Church, let's look back so we can look forward. You know, these early stories in Genesis chapters 6 through 11, what we're skimming through today, it's fascinating, first of all, to imagine that humans for thousands of years have been looking at these same stories and trying to make sense of them. Even that connects us, I think, with such a large swath of humanity. The story of the flood, the story of the Tower of Babel, they stun us when you read them again freshly. What is going on here? You know, authors comprise stories. They tell them to convey their message, to carry their points. So the best readings of these stories and the interpretations is not going to focus on our curious questions, which I have zillions when I come to this story. So many questions. The best readings and interpretations are going to do our darndest to figure out what is this author attempting to communicate. When we get to those places, we're really digging in on the heart of it. And what we must do when we do this is recognize our own lenses. As one of my favorites, Richard Rohr, always says, we don't read the Bible as it is. We read the Bible as we are. The story of Joseph, for example, it's coming up in a few weeks for us. The story of Joseph, I was told one time, was read to a group of North Africans and a group of Western Europeans. And they were asked a simple question. What's the main point of this story? The Western European said, well, it's a story, obviously, about resilience, how you need to stick with it, whatever it is that you're doing, and things will work out. The North Africans, on the other hand, said, it's a story about how family will always be loyal. We don't read the story as it is. We read the story as we are. We do better when we identify what our lenses are and recognize them. My wife Heather and I, we often must ask clarifying questions to our three teenagers. Humans who came from our flesh were raised under our direction. Yet we have to ask clarifying questions about some of the words or phrases or actions in their lives because we don't understand them. Because of the cultural differences in one generation in the same house of the same blood. Put that to scale. We're talking about stories from 3,500 years ago on the other side of the planet. Of course, they don't make obvious sense. Our own children don't make obvious sense. Well, one enormous cultural difference that I would love if this settled in over us that the ancient Near East carried and that guided their understanding and how the stories were given to them is the simple difference between an individual and a group-oriented life. A group-oriented life truly understands itself by the groups that it's a part of. It doesn't identify first as a human. It identifies first as this is my family, my tribe, my nation. And that's how I understand who I am. I'm participating in this group because this is me. And so my driving question is, how can I benefit the group? What can I do to make the group better? Because that's me. In an individual-oriented society, which is a very late addition in the whole human scope of things, and one that we live in and is increasingly becoming normal around the globe, sees itself first. It understands its own identity first and then participates in groups so long as it's a perceived benefit of the individual. I'm me first, and I participate in groups here and there. So people who have a group orientation to life, when they read a story about Noah or Babel, they're instinctively going to associate with the whole of the story. Not just pick out an individual to find it, but this determines so much, especially in the Hebrew Scriptures, but it stretches all the way through our New Testament. So then when they read in chapter 6, verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thought of their hearts was evil continually, they would naturally identify with the whole of that story. They would say things like, oh, yeah, I've been there. When all of my inclination, when I wanted revenge so badly, when I got so greedy, when I was overwhelmed or consumed by my own lust, my inclination was evil. They would identify with the progression of the evil. First, there was Adam and Eve who questioned, is these laws really apply to us? And then something bad happened. And it progresses then to Cain, who gave full vent to his jealousy and murdered his brother and refuses to examine himself and his motives for this. And worse things happened to him. The momentum builds and it even starts to dominate the destruction of life with the story of Noah. All of it is bad. We go from one step to the next, and it gets increasingly worse and worse. And they would identify with the whole group sense of that because we've been there. And when we're really honest and looking at it, we can see that too in our own lives. Just one tilt off. That went this way and then further and then deeper. You know, I've been the pastor here now for 12 years over that. And about 11 years ago, learned one of my early lessons. We were working with a woman who was on staff with us. And she had recently lost her long-term husband very unexpectedly. And they were way too young. And she was on record with us in multiple staff meetings saying, no, you're right in reading this. I have not dealt with this grief. I feel like if I go there, I'll never be able to come back. So I'm pushing it at bay. I'm holding it back. And well, like always, grief and all of our other emotions, they demand our attention. We can push that beach ball underneath the water, but it's going to come up somewhere. And because of that, it was making a mess of the responsibilities that she had here. It wasn't going well by anybody's standards. One day, she came into my office and announced that she got another job in town and was going to hang on for about 4 or 5 months and then get that new thing started. I was one tick off. I was a younger pastor, and I wanted things just to go well, and this wasn't going well. And so in the blindness of my own ambition, I said, oh, I'm glad to hear that, and you're not hanging on for 4 more months. You're out of here today, and we're going to start over. Next to this open, gaping wound of this woman having lost her husband, I went ahead and inserted my own dagger into her side and made things worse in her life. when we're honest and able to look back at our own lives, we can recognize ourselves in the whole of the story. The destruction of humanity was terrible, and the ancient Near Easterners would have recognized that. And as we've been there, so we've also been here. In 6:8, the text says, "But Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord." Noah walked with God. We can say this, that also describes my existence. I've been there as well. I've always sensed that there's like this candle inside of me that's connecting me to the living God, that has the gaze of God on me. And whether or not there's water that's sloshing around or there's wind that can't blow the candle out, somehow the gaze of God is upon me and called me to do things that I never could have imagined that I would be doing and put me in places. I get that. Noah found favor. Sometimes that's exactly, if I allow it, what my existence feels like. I've felt spared so many times by the living God who comes out and rescues me and brings me to a better place from all of the destruction that is around me. And after that, the boat finally gets to the dry ground, the water subsides. And priority one for Noah, build a vineyard, right? Hey, you know what else the floods wiped out? All the wine. Eh? Let's get this going. He gets so drunk after the lands and builds his vineyard that he passes out naked. And one of his kids sees him, this ultimate shaming act that was going on there. So he's not just a little bit tipsy. If you're passing out drunk naked, that's way overboard and gone. And that's him there. And what amazes me about the text is it really doesn't dig into Noah about this behavior. It blames the sun for seeing him. I don't understand what that part is all about. But if I was there, I would say, Noah, this is on you, pal. This isn't on your kid. You didn't have to be naked. There's that identity as well. It's the mix. It's the this wickedness, but we're also finding ourselves being saved, and then we're also finding ourselves back off track again. You know, this followed. They started this work project motivated by selfish ambition. We want to make a name for ourselves. And this only is going to then amplify the significance of the self. Let's build this huge tower that everybody is so impressed by. Let's do this. And when that's the goal, let's make everybody look at us. There can really only be one person there. So it's going to result in tribalism, in splintering, in a dispersion of people as opposed to a unification. And so the people of the ancient Near East would have recognized themselves in the whole of this story. When we're so off track, when we're so on track, when our lives are just a mix of all of the above. And I do want to clarify, when I say story, I don't mean something that someone sat down one day and made up. There actually is a fair amount of significant geological evidence that suggests a very large regional flood in that part of the world at that time, not to mention the surrounding cultures also had stories about great floods that swept away so much of humanity. But I also do not mean, as we're saying here, history as recorded as we understand history. These are two separate types of pieces of literature. And then that would significantly miss the point. It would be us insisting that they did it the way that we do it, and that would be putting us in the middle instead of us figuring out how they do it. We do far better to strive for what the author is portraying and that allow that to shape who we are. What becomes very clear in these stories is that the lead character isn't Noah, and it's not the people of Babel. The lead character is Yahweh. It's a story about God as the main character. It's a story about what God sees, right? God sees their wickedness, that it was so great. And in that, it's a story about what God feels. This is a text that tells us that God has emotions. God is feeling, is responding. It said it grieved him to his heart. The word for grieved that the author uses there is the exact same word that is used for the type of pain that a woman experiences in childbirth. He's crushed. It says he was sorry that he brought humanity to light, because nothing can move a parent like their child. Nothing moves, grieves them, makes them sorrowful. When a parent observes that their children are wandering foolishly and destroying things, they grieve. That's when they experience their deepest sorrow, and that's the picture of the God here in this story. God also saw that Noah was good. And God, in fact, saw everything, the tower and why they were building it. It's a story about what God sees. It's also a story about what God does. God is the one blotting out, the main character driving the narrative. When evil is practiced, it's never, forever tolerated. Does that quantify as a double negative? Never? I don't know. Never and forever tolerated. Eventually, evil will crumble. The reader notes, this lead character is extraordinarily powerful. Very powerful to both bring creation here. The waters covered the earth, and the waters subsided in the first two chapters. And then God does it again. The waters are separated, and then they come together and cover the earth. It's clearly a story about a do-over. Another shot at creation. God sends the rain, sends the wind, remembers Noah, blesses Noah. So here in this second creation, this do-over that humanity gets is graciously instructing humans to be fruitful and multiplying again, and promising, putting his bow in the sky, promising, I won't flood the world again, establishing a covenant. Pulling it together, an agreement, saying, I will do it this way. It's a story about what God sees, about what God does, about what God says, and mostly an agreement that God is making with humanity. The author is going so far out of their way to show that this powerful lead character is the one that created and blessed everything, that when those in the supporting roles, you and I, when we mess things up, it's God who creates the agreement of how things will come together again. Seven separate times in the story about Noah, God says something like, I will establish my covenant. This is one of the greatest mercies and best things that we could hear as humans. It's not on our shoulders to make the relationship right. It's on God's. And God has done what is necessary to be done. It is ours simply to believe the fantastically good news that we are given. The author is making the main point so obvious that while humans really are largely a hot mess, nevertheless, God is faithful. While humans go off and do what they do, nevertheless, God remains faithful. Each of our lives is that epic drama. Each of our lives lives that creation story. It is our story, as the rest of Scripture, how God is initiating and blessing the story, insisting that the core of who we are is blessed and in the image of God. But then humans are disobedient and we suffer because of it. But nevertheless, God remains faithful and continues to offer fresh starts. The story is communicating that, yes, our decisions matter greatly, and we are more free than we want to be and can handle. And we have behaved oftentimes, and it gives us inescapable and long-term consequences. But the story is communicating that more important than that, we have a God who continues to initiate and start things over again, allowing fresh starts for the humans that he has created. That as powerful as humans are, our God is more powerful. That as big of a deal as what we see and what we say and what we do matters, what matters more is what God sees and God says and God does. And the story continues, obviously, under the direction of where the living God wants it to go, in God's time and in God's way. Watching the whole story then unfold, we find what the author intended. We find ourselves seeking, living in gratitude. We find ourselves offering respect to this God, and we find ourselves with more and more reasons to trust. What we need as we engage these stories is perspective. Several years ago, Heather and I, we planted one of our first gardens in our yard, and Heather planned it. She planted it, watered it, and harvested. And along the way, our now a 19-year-old was about 3 at the time. She helped. And she would do what mom said to do, and we wanted her to help and get in there. But she wasn't driving the story. Heather was. She made the whole thing come together. She drew the plot. She decided what to plant. And nature was taking its course. And did Natanya help out? Sure. People, that's us. And frankly, I think that's even generous. To be able to say we're 3 years old before the living God, playing our part. It removes us from being the center character and allows the living God to be the one who is driving it. We need this perspective to know that the gardener does indeed see us, remembers us, blesses us, and by grace will not permit us to get away with our sinful lives. Most importantly, the gardener covenants with us. The gardener is the one who makes the agreements and keeps them. I'll put my bow in the sky. To remember this covenant, which of course is a foreshadowing to the next covenant that he's going to make with Abram. And the next covenants that he's going to make with Israel. And the next covenant that he's going to make through his very own son, who also observed our condition and came to be with us and decided it was heading to the cross to declare that this is the new covenant. It's all about the agreements that God makes with us. And so when Jesus gathered his disciples together, as they were remembering God's faithfulness in their Passover meal, where God had pulled them out of slavery and brought them into the wilderness and ultimately the promised land, they were recalling that covenant that God had made. And Jesus, with all boldness, is able to say, and actually, here's a new one. And he took the bread and he broke it. And he said, this is my body. Take and eat of it, ingest it. And in the same way, he took the cup and he filled it up. And then he gave him the words, this is the new covenant, the new arrangement, the agreement of how things are. God always remaining faithful and calling us to himself, and us finding fresh starts all along the way that God continues to offer up to us. And he told them, as often as you eat this bread and you drink this cup, you declare my death. You're proclaiming this covenant. You're recognizing and also accepting that this is the way that it is between humanity and God. And so this morning, each one of you is invited, followers of Christ, come forward. Receive the bread. Drink from the cup of the new covenant. His blood poured out for the forgiveness of sins. You don't think your life deserves that fresh start. But it doesn't matter what you think ultimately. What matters most is what the living God thinks. If we allow the story to teach us, that's what the story says. What's most important is what the main character wants, and that the supporting characters get on board with the main plot. There'll be 3 stations up here before you today. Take your time to receive the kind of grace that our God wants to offer you. All of our staff and our council will be serving you. To your right will be the gluten-free station. In the glass cup, there's wine. In the pewter cup, there is juice. Come to the table. He has established his covenant.